In yet another part of the forest, a young shaman was undergoing a very essential part of his training. He had eaten of the sacred toadstool, he had smoked the holy rhizome, and had carefully powdered up and inserted into various orifices the mystic mushroom, and now, sitting cross-legged under a pine tree, he was concentrating firstly on making contact with the strange and wonderful secrets at the heart of being, but mainly on stopping the top of his head from unscrewing and floating away. Blue four-side triangles pinwheeled across his vision. Occasionally he smiled knowingly at nothing very much and said things like, "Wow," and There was a movement in the air, and what he later described as like a sort of explosion, only backwards, you know. And suddenly, where there had only been nothing, there was a large, battered wooden chest. It landed heavily on the leaf mould, extended dozens of little legs, and turned round ponderously to look at the shaman. That is to say, it had no face, but even through the mycological haze, he was horribly aware that it was looking at him. And not a nice look, either. It was amazing how baleful a keyhole and a couple of knotholes could be. To his intense relief, it gave a sort of wooden shrug and set off through the trees at a canter. With superhuman effort, the shaman recalled the correct sequence of movements for standing up, and even managed a couple of steps before he looked down and gave up, having run out of legs. Rincewind, meanwhile, had found a path. It wound about a good deal, and he would have been happier if it had been cobbled, but following it gave him something to do. Several trees tried to strike up a conversation, but Rincewind was nearly certain that this was not normal behaviour for trees and ignored them. The day lengthened. There was no sound but the murmur of nasty little stinging insects, the occasional crack of a falling branch, and the whispering of the trees discussing religion and the trouble with squirrels. Rincewind began to feel very lonely. He imagined himself living in the woods forever, sleeping on leaves and eating whatever there was to eat in the woods. Trees, he supposed, and nuts and berries. He would have to... Rincewind! There, coming up the path, was Twoflower, dripping wet but beaming with delight. The luggage trotted along behind him. Anything made of the wood would follow its owner anywhere, and it was often used to make luggage for the grave goods of very rich dead kings who wanted to be sure of starting a new life in the next world with clean underwear. Rincewind sighed. Up to now, he'd thought the day couldn't possibly get worse. It began to rain, a particularly wet and cold rain. Rincewind and Twoflower sat under a tree and watched it.
Rincewind? Why are we here?
Well, some say that the creator of the universe made the disc and everything on it. Others say that it's all a very complicated story involving the testicles of the sky god and the milk of the celestial cow, and some even hold that we're all just due to the total random accretion of probability particles. But if you mean why are we here, as opposed to falling off the disc, I haven't the faintest idea. It's probably all some ghastly mistake.
Oh, do you think there's anything to eat in this forest?
Yes, said the wizard bitterly. Us.
I've got some acorns, if you like, said the tree helpfully. They sat in damp silence for some moments.
Rincewind, the tree said...
Trees can't talk, snapped Rincewind. It's very important to remember that.
But you just heard.
Rincewind sighed. Look, he said, it's all down to simple biology, isn't it? If you're going to talk, you need the right equipment, like lungs and lips and...
Vocal cords, said the tree.
Yeah, them, said Rincewind. He shut up and stared gloomily at the rain.
I thought wizards knew all about trees and wild food and things, said Twoflower reproachfully. It was very seldom that anything in his voice suggested that he thought of Rincewind as anything other than a magnificent enchanter, and the wizard was stung into action.
I do, he snapped.
Well, what kind of tree is this? Said the tourist.
Rincewind looked up. Beech, he said firmly.
Actually,
began the tree, and shut up quickly. It had caught Rincewind's look.
Those things up there look like acorns, said Twoflower.
"Yes, well, this is the sessile or heptacarpic variety," said Rincewind. "The nuts look very much like acorns. In fact, they can fool practically anybody."
"Gosh," said Twoflower. "And what's that bush over there?"
"Mistletoe."
"But it's got thorns and red berries." "Well?" said Rincewind sternly, and stared hard at him. Twoflower broke first.
"Nothing," he said meekly. "I must have been misinformed."
"Right."
"But there's some big mushrooms under it. Can you eat them?"
Rincewind looked at them cautiously. They were indeed very big, and had red and white spotted caps. They were in fact a variety that the local shaman, who at this point was some miles away making friends with a rock, would only eat after first attaching one leg to a large stone with a rope. There was nothing for it but to go out in the rain and look at them. He knelt down in the leaf mould and peered under the cap. After a while, he said weakly, "No, no good to eat at all."
"Why?" called Twoflower. "Are the gills the wrong shade of yellow?"
"No, not really.
I expect the stems haven't got the right kind of fluting, then."
"They look okay, actually."
"The cap, then. I expect the cap is the wrong colour," said Twoflower.
"Not sure about that."
"Well, then why can't you eat them?"
Rincewind coughed. "It's the little doors and windows," he said wretchedly. "It's a dead giveaway."
Thunder rolled across the unseen university. Rain poured over its roofs and gurgled out of its gargoyles, although one or two of the more cunning ones had scuttled off to shelter among the maze of tiles. Far below, in the great hall, the 8 most powerful wizards on the Discworld gathered at the angles of a ceremonial octagram. Actually, they probably weren't the most powerful, if truth were known, but they certainly had great powers of survival, which in the highly competitive world of magic was pretty much the same thing. Behind every wizard of the 8th rank were half a dozen 7th rank wizards trying to bump him off, and senior wizards had to develop an inquiring attitude to, for example, scorpions in their bed. An ancient proverb summed it up. When a wizard is tired of looking for broken glass in his dinner, it ran, he is tired of life. The oldest wizard, Greyhald Spold of the ancient and truly original sages of the Unbroken Circle, leaned heavily on his carven staff and spake thusly.
"Get on with it, Weatherwax! My feet are giving me jip!"
Golder, who had merely paused for effect, glared at him.
"Very well, then. I will be brief."
"Jolly good."
"We all sought guidance as to the events of this morning. Can anyone among us say he received it?"
The wizards looked sidelong at one another. Nowhere outside a trades union conference fraternal benefit night can so much mutual distrust and suspicion be found as among a gathering of senior enchanters. But the plain fact was that the day had gone very badly. Normally, informative demons, summoned abruptly from the dungeon dimensions, had looked sheepish and sidled away when questioned. Magic mirrors had cracked, tarot cards had mysteriously become blank. Crystal balls had gone all cloudy. Even tea leaves, normally scorned by wizards as frivolous and unworthy of contemplation, had clustered together at the bottom of cups and refused to move. In short, the assembled wizards were at a loss. There was a general murmur of agreement.
"And therefore I propose we perform the rite of Ashk-Ente," said Golder dramatically.
He had to admit that he had hoped for a better response, something along the lines of, well,
"No, not the rite of Ashk-Ente. Man was not meant to meddle with such things."
In fact, there was a general mutter of approval.
"Good idea."
"Seems reasonable. Well, get on with it, then."
Slightly put out, he summoned a procession of lesser wizards who carried various magical implements into the hall. It has already been hinted that around this time there was some disagreement among the fraternity of wizards about how to practice magic. Younger wizards in particular went about saying that it was time that magic started to update its image, and that they should all stop mucking about with bits of wax and bone and put the whole thing on a properly organized basis with research programs and 3-day conventions in good hotels where they could read papers with titles like Wither Geomancy and The Role of 7-League Boots in a Caring Society. Trumon, for example, hardly ever did any magic these days, but ran the order with hourglass efficiency and wrote lots of memos and had a big charter on his office wall covered with coloured blobs and flags and lines that no one else really understood, but which looked very impressive. The other type of wizard thought all this was so much marsh gas and wouldn't have anything to do with an image unless it was made of wax and had pins stuck in it. The heads of the 8 orders were all of this persuasion, traditionalists to a mage, and the utensils that were heaped around the octagram had a definite no-nonsense occult look about them. Ram's horns, skulls, baroque metalwork, and heavy candles were much in evidence, despite the discovery by younger wizards that the rite of Ashk-Enti could perfectly well be performed with 3 small bits of wood and 4 cubic centimetres of mouse blood. The preparations normally took several hours, but the combined powers of the senior wizards shortened it considerably, and after a mere 40 minutes, Golda chanted the final words of the spell. They hung in front of him for a moment before dissolving. The air in the centre of the octagram shimmered and thickened, and suddenly contained a tall, dark figure. Most of it was hidden by a black robe and hood, and this was probably just as well. It had a long scythe in one hand, and one couldn't help noticing that what should have been fingers was simply white bone. The other skeletal hand held small cubes of cheese and pineapple on a stick.
"Well,"
said Death, in a voice with all the warmth and colour of an iceberg. He caught the wizard's gaze and glanced down at the stick.
"I was at a party,"
he added, a shade reproachfully.
"Oh, creature of earth and darkness, we do charge thee to abjure from—" began Golda in a firm, commanding voice.
Death nodded.
"Yes, yes, I know all that. Why have you summoned me?"
"It is said that you can see both the past and the future," said Golda, a little sulkily, because the big speech of binding and conjuration was one he rather liked, and people said he was very good at it.
"That is absolutely correct."
"Then perhaps you can tell us what exactly it was that happened this morning," said Golda.
He pulled himself together and added loudly,
"I command this by Azimrotha, by T'Chikel, by—"
"All right, you've made your point. What precisely was it you wished to know? Quite a lot of things happened this morning. People were born, people died, all the trees grew a bit taller, ripples made an interesting pattern on the sea."
"I mean about the octavo," said Golda coldly.
"That? Oh, that was just a readjustment of reality. I understand the octavo was anxious not to lose the 8th spell. It was dropping off the disc, apparently."
"Hold on, hold on," said Golda. He scratched his chin. "Are we talking about the one inside the head of Rincewind? Tall, thin man? Bit scraggy? The one—"
"That he has been carrying around all these years, yes."
Golda frowned. It seemed a lot of trouble to go to. Everyone knew that when a wizard died, all the spells in his head would go free, so why bother to save Rincewind? The spell would just float back eventually.
"Any idea why?"
he said, without thinking, and then remembering himself in time, added hastily,
"By Iripf and K'Charla, I do abjure thee, and—"
"I wish you wouldn't keep doing that. All that I know is that all the spells have to be said together next Hogswatch night, or the disc will be destroyed."
"Speak up there," demanded Greyhound Spold.
"Shut up," said Golda.
"Me?"
"No, him, daft old—" "I heard that," snapped Spold. "You young people—"
He stopped. Death was looking at him thoughtfully, as if he was trying to remember his face.
"Look," said Golda. "Just repeat that bit again, will you? The disc will be what?"
"Destroyed. Can I go now? I left my drink."
"Hang on," said Golda hurriedly. "By Celliliki and Orizoni and so forth. What do you mean, destroyed?"
"It's an ancient prophecy written on the inner walls of the Great Pyramid of Tsort. The word destroyed seems quite self-explanatory to me."
"That's all you can tell us?"
"Yes."
"But Hogswatch night is only 2 months away."
"Yes."
"At least you can tell us where Rincewind is now."
Death shrugged. It was a gesture he was particularly well built for.
"The forests of Skund, Rimwoods of the Ramtop Mountains."
What is he doing there?
Feeling very sorry for himself.
Oh.
Now may I go?
Golda nodded distractedly. He had been thinking wistfully of the banishment ritual which started, "Begone, foul shade," and had some rather impressive passages which he had been practicing, but somehow he couldn't work up any enthusiasm. Oh, yes, he said. Thank you, yes. And then, because it's as well not to make enemies even among the creatures of the night, he added politely, I hope it is a good party. Death didn't answer. He was looking at Spold in the same way that a dog looks at a bone, only in this case things were more or less the other way round. I said I hope it is a good party, said Golda loudly.
At the moment it is. I think it might go downhill very quickly at midnight.
Why?
That's when they think I'll be taking my mask off.
He vanished, leaving only a cocktail stick and a short paper streamer behind. There had been an unseen observer of all this. It was, of course, entirely against the rules, but Trumon knew all about rules and had always considered they were for making, not obeying. Long before the eight mages had got down to some serious arguing about what the apparition had meant, he was down in the main levels of the university library. It was an awe-inspiring place. Many of the books were magical, and the important thing to remember about grimoires is that they are deadly in the hands of any librarian who cares about order, because he's bound to stick them all on the same shelf. This is not a good idea with books that tend to leak magic, because more than one or two of them together form a critical black mass. On top of that, many of the lesser spells are quite particular about the company they keep, and tend to express any objections by hurling their books viciously across the room. And of course there is always the half-felt presence of the things from the dungeon dimensions, clustering around the magical leakage and constantly probing the walls of reality. The job of magical librarian, who has to spend his working days in this sort of highly charged atmosphere, is a high-risk occupation. The head librarian was sitting on top of his desk, quietly peeling an orange, and was well aware of that. He glanced up when Trumon entered.
I'm looking for anything we've got on the Pyramid of Chut, said Trumon. He'd come prepared. He took a banana out of his pocket.
The librarian looked at it mournfully and then flopped down heavily on the floor. Trumon found a soft hand poked gently into his, and the librarian led the way, waddling sadly between the bookshelves. It was like holding a little leather glove. Around them, the books sizzled and sparked with the occasional discharge of undirected magic flashing over to the carefully placed earthing rods nailed on the shelves. There was a tinny blue smell, and just at the very limit of hearing, the horrible chittering of the dungeon creatures. Like many other parts of Unseen University, the library occupied rather more space than its outside dimensions would suggest, because magic distorts space in strange ways, and it was probably the only library in the universe with Mobius shelves. But the librarian's mental catalogue was ticking over perfectly. He stopped by a soaring stack of musty books and swung himself up into the darkness. There was the sound of rustling paper, and a cloud of dust floated down to Trumon. Then the librarian was back, a slim volume in his hands.
Ugh, he said.
Trumon took it gingerly. The cover was scratched and very dog-eared. The gold of its lettering had long ago curled off, but he could just make out in the old magic tongue of the Tsort Valley the words Eyet Griet Teimpel Heet Tsort E History Miestical.
Ugh,
said the librarian anxiously. Trumon turned the pages cautiously. He wasn't very good at languages. He'd always found them highly inefficient things which by rights ought to be replaced by some sort of easily understood numerical system. But this seemed exactly what he was looking for. There were whole pages covered with meaningful hieroglyphs.
"Is this the only book you've got about the Pyramid of Tsort?" he said slowly. "Ook."
"You're quite sure?"
"Ook."
Trumon listened. He could hear a long way off the sound of approaching feet and arguing voices. But he'd been prepared for that, too. He reached into his pocket.
"Would you like another banana?" he said. The forest of Skund was indeed enchanted, which was nothing unusual on the disc, and was also the only forest in the whole universe to be called, in the local language, "Your Finger, You Fool," which was the literal meaning of the word Skund. The reason for this is regrettably all too common. When the first explorers from the warm lands around the Circle Sea travelled into the chilly hinterland, they filled in the blank spaces on their maps by grabbing the nearest native, pointing at some distant landmark, speaking very clearly in a loud voice, and writing down whatever the bemused man told them. Thus were immortalised in generations of atlases such geographical oddities as "Just a mountain," "I don't know," "What?" and, of course, "Your Finger, You Fool." Rain clouds clustered around the bald heights of Mount Ulskunrahod. Who is this fool who does not know what a mountain is? And the luggage settled itself more comfortably under a dripping tree, which tried unsuccessfully to strike up a conversation. Twoflower and Rincewind were arguing. The person they were arguing about sat on his mushroom and watched them with interest. He looked like someone who smelled like someone who lived in a mushroom, and that bothered Twoflower.
"Well, why hasn't he got a red hat?"
Rincewind hesitated, desperately trying to imagine what Twoflower was getting at.
"What?"
he said, giving in.
"He should have a red hat," said Twoflower. "And he certainly ought to be cleaner and more sort of jolly. He doesn't look like any sort of gnome to me."
"What are you going on about?"
"Look at that beard," said Twoflower sternly. "I've seen better beards on a piece of cheese."
"Look! He's 6 inches high, and he lives in a mushroom," snarled Rincewind. "Of course he's a bloody gnome!"
"We've only got his word for it!"
Rincewind looked down at the gnome.
"Excuse me," he said.
He took Twoflower to the other side of the clearing.
"Listen," he said between his teeth.
"If he was 15 feet tall, and he said he was a giant, we'd only have his word for that too, wouldn't we?"
"He could be a goblin," said Twoflower defiantly.
Rincewind looked back at the tiny figure, which was industriously picking its nose.
"Well," he said, "so what? Gnome, goblin, pixie, so what?"
"No, not a pixie," said Twoflower firmly. "Pixies, they wear these sort of green combinations, and they have pointy caps and little knobbly antenna thingies sticking out of their heads. I've seen pictures."
"Where?"
Twoflower hesitated and looked at his feet.
"I think it was called the...
"The what?
Called the what?"
The little man took a sudden interest in the backs of his hands.
"The Little Folk's Book of Flower Fairies," he muttered.
Rincewind looked blank.
"It's a book on how to avoid them," he said.
"Oh, no," said Twoflower hurriedly. "It tells you where to look for them. I can remember the pictures now."
A dreamy look came over his face, and Rincewind groaned inwardly.
"There was even a special fairy that came and took your teeth away."
"What, came and pulled out your actual teeth?"
"No, no, you're wrong. I mean, after they'd fallen out, what you did was you put the tooth under your pillow, and the fairy came and took it away and left a rhino piece."
"Why?"
"Why what?"
"Why did it collect teeth?"
"It just did."
Rincewind formed a mental picture of some strange entity living in a castle made of teeth. It was the kind of mental picture you tried to forget. Unsuccessfully.
"Ugh," he said.
Red hats. He wondered whether to enlighten the tourist about what life was really like, when a frog was a good meal, a rabbit hole a useful place to shelter out of the rain, and an owl a drifting silent terror in the night. Moleskin trousers sounded quaint unless you personally had to remove them from their original owner when the vicious little sod was cornered in his burrow. As for red hats, anyone who went around a forest looking bright and conspicuous would only do so very, very briefly. He wanted to say, "Look, the life of gnomes and goblins is nasty, brutish, and short. So are they." He wanted to say all this and couldn't. For a man with an itch to see the whole of infinity, Twoflower never actually moved outside his own head. Telling him the truth would be like kicking a spaniel. Said a voice by his foot. He looked down. The gnome, who had introduced himself as Swires, looked up. Rincewind had a very good ear for languages. The gnome had just said, "I've got some newt sorbet left over from yesterday." "Sounds wonderful," said Rincewind. Swires gave him another prod in the ankle.
"The other bigger, is he all right?"
he said solicitously. "He's just suffering from reality shock," said Rincewind. "You haven't got a red hat, by any chance?"
"Wheat?"
"It's just a thought."
"I know where there's some food for biggers," said the gnome. "And shelter, too. It's not far."
Rincewind looked at the lowering sky. The daylight was draining out of the landscape, and the clouds looked as if they had heard about snow and were considering the idea. Of course, people who lived in mushrooms couldn't necessarily be trusted, but right now a trap baited with a hot meal and clean sheets would have had the wizard hammering to get in. They set off. After a few seconds, the luggage got carefully to its feet and started to follow.
Psst!
It turned carefully, little legs moving up in a complicated pattern, and appeared to look up.
"Is it good being joinery?"
said the tree anxiously.
"Did it hurt?"
The luggage seemed to think about this. Every brass handle, every knothole radiated extreme concentration. Then it shrugged its lid and waddled away. The tree sighed and shook a few dead leaves out of its twigs. The cottage was small, tumble-down, and as ornate as a doily. Some mad whittler had got to work on it, Rincewind decided, and had created terrible havoc before he could be dragged away. Every door, every shutter, had its clusters of wooden grapes and half-moon cutouts, and there were massed outbreaks of fretwork pine cones all over the walls. He half expected a giant cuckoo to come hurtling out of an upper window. What he also noticed was the characteristic greasy feel in the air. Tiny green and purple sparks flashed from his fingernails. "Strong magical field," he muttered. 100 million thaums at least." A thaum is the basic unit of magical strength. It has been universally established as the amount of magic needed to create one small white pigeon, or 3 normal-sized billiard balls.
"There's magic all over the place," said Swires. "An old witch used to live around here. She went a long time ago, but the magic still keeps the house going."
"Here, there's something odd about that door," said Twoflower. "Why should a house need magic to keep it going?" said Rincewind. Twoflower touched a wall gingerly.
"It's all sticky." "Nougat," said Swires. "Good grief. A real gingerbread cottage. Rincewind, a real gingerbread—"
Rincewind nodded glumly. "Yeah, the confectionery school of architecture," he said. "It never caught on." He looked suspiciously at the licorice door knocker.
"It sort of regenerates," said Swires. "Marvellous, really. You just don't get this sort of place nowadays. You just can't get the gingerbread."
"Really?" said Rincewind gloomily.
"Come on in," said the gnome. "But mind the door, Matt."
"Why?"
"Candy floss."
The great disk spun slowly under its toiling sun, and daylight pooled in hollows and finally drained away as night fell. In his chilly room in Unseen University, Trumon pored over the book, his lips moving as his finger traced the unfamiliar ancient script. He read that the Great Pyramid... He read that its height plus its length, divided by half its width, equaled exactly 1.67563, or precisely 1,237.98712567, times the difference between the distance to the sun and the weight of a small orange. He learned that 60 years had been devoted entirely to its construction. It all seemed, he thought, to be rather a lot of trouble to go to just to sharpen a razor blade. And in the forest of Skund, Twoflower and Rincewind settled down to a meal of gingerbread mantelpiece, and the produced, rolled himself a cigarette, entirely unaware of the role that lay in store for him. It was quite an interesting tailor-made that he twirled expertly between his fingers, because, like many of the wandering wizards from whom he had picked up the art, he was in the habit of saving dog-ends in a leather bag and rolling them into fresh smokes. The implacable law of averages therefore dictated that some of the tobacco had been smoked almost continuously for many years now. The thing he was trying unsuccessfully to light was, well, you could have coated roads with it. So great was the reputation of this person that a group of nomadic barbarian horsemen had respectfully invited him to join them as they sat around a horse-turd fire.
The nomads of the hub regions usually migrated rimwards for the winter, and these were part of a tribe who had pitched their felt tents in the sweltering heat wave of a mere -3 degrees and were going around with peeling noses and complaining about heatstroke. The barbarian chieftain said,
"What, then, are the greatest things that a man may find in life?"
This is the sort of thing you're supposed to say to maintain step cred in barbarian circles. The man on his right thoughtfully drank his cocktail of mare's milk and snowcat blood and spoke thus.
"The crisp horizon of the steppe, the wind in your hair, a fresh horse under you."
The man on his left said,
"The cry of the white eagle in the heights, the fall of the snow in the forest, a true arrow in your bow."
The chieftain nodded and said,
"Surely it is the sight of your enemy slain, the humiliation of his tribe, and the lamentation of his women."
There was a general murmur of whiskery approval at this outrageous display. Then the chieftain turned respectfully to his guest, a small figure carefully warming his chilblains by the fire, and said,
"But our guest, whose name is Legend, must tell us truly, what is it that a man may call the greatest things in life?"
The guest paused in the middle of another unsuccessful attempt to light up.
"What shall I?"
he said toothlessly.
"I said, what is it that a man may call the greatest things in life?"
The warriors leaned closer. This should be worth hearing. The guest thought long and hard and then said with deliberation,
"Hot water, good dentistry, and soft lavatory paper."